Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Next hour, the future of the Los Angeles River, which of course was central to the founding of Los Angeles, the Pueblo, when it started here. We're going to talk about what comes next with this decades-long planning process and what are some of the neighborhood concerns, those who live close to the river and what they're seeing in the draft. But right now, our focus on COVID-19, some positive news that we are so glad to see with case positivity rates, hospitalizations down, and we anticipate the death rate from COVID-19 to be declining in coming weeks as well. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center with us. Thank you so much, Dr. Chin Hong. Good to have you with us this morning.
Great to be here, Larry, on an unseasonably warm day in San Francisco.
And here, too, in Southern California all this week. So we're sharing this this very nice weather in early summer, so to speak. Let's talk, first of all, about just the overall state of COVID-19. It feels like every day things are improving bit by bit. Is that your sense?
Yes, I share a collective sigh of relief of me and my colleagues and the community at large, I think, in sort of weathering this winter surge, winter darkness that we've seen.
And are we going to see the death rate from COVID-19 start to decline as precipitously? Because I know that's a trailing indicator.
Yes, I believe so. And even if we get a surge in the future, I'm hoping that the death rate would remain low, simply because most of the nursing homes and congregate settings have been immunized already. So that is really where the bulk of our deaths are, more than 75%. So if at least that population is robustly protected, that will, you know, hopefully not lead to a surge in ICU beds and hospitalizations, even if we get a community surge in the future.
We're getting many questions already about, once people are vaccinated twice and have gone 2 weeks past their second vaccination, about what the potential is of them to shed the virus to unvaccinated people. In other words, harbor the virus, even though it's not making the vaccinated person sick, but that it would airborne be transmitted from the vaccinated person to the person who's unprotected. Dr. Fauci today said that there may be some CDC relaxed guidance for people that are fully vaccinated about them getting together, and that could be coming soon. What do you anticipate that changed guidance will include?
So I anticipate, and this is a message I think, clinicians have been sort of under the radar or over the radar giving for some time now, is that in private intimate settings with vaccinated people, you can relax your guard, you can hug each other, you can have, that life that you aspired to pre-COVID. But once you leave that intimate setting and you go into society, you know, you'd still need to maintain those protections given the uncertainty of what we talked about, transmission. In the heart of hearts, I do believe that, you know, that it would also prove in the future to not lead to transmission, but we just don't have the data. We have the data that you don't get viral shedding in the people who've been vaccinated, which biologically leads to lower transmission. We just don't have the human data yet.
Joe in West Hollywood cites a study, and I haven't seen this, but from Israel, indicating that the Pfizer vaccine is effective at preventing transmission. Have you had a chance to look at that?
I haven't seen that Israel data. I have seen Israel population data showing that in general as a population, and there's also data in Canada, China, and in parts of the U.S., like the Mayo study released a report recently showing that, you know, in the real world, vaccine usage did, you know, result in, you know, lower rates, lower potential transmissions, etc. But it, you know, the data is not just, put, you know, 100% conclusive yet. But, you know, again, the writing is on the wall for me in terms of it going to lead to that fact. We know this from other infectious diseases. when you have low amounts of virus or no virus in your nose, that's detectable, you probably won't transmit anything that's sub-therapeutic or sub-detectable.
All right. And even if that is shown to be the case, I would presume we're all still going to need to wear face coverings when we go into public places because we won't have any way of knowing who's vaccinated or not.
Exactly. So there, you know, coming back to that immunity bubble that I talked about in the intimate setting where you have a group of vaccinated people getting together without protection, the larger the group, the higher the chance of two things. One is that even in vaccinated people, there's a chance that they didn't respond. That's 5% on average in Pfizer Moderna, but could be as high as 30% if you look at a vaccine like J&J or AstraZeneca. So the bigger the group, the higher the chance of two people not responding, being able to transmit it to each other. But it depends on community prevalence as well.
Yeah. So a small group, let's say six people getting together, pretty low risk statistically there.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, I think many people have been dismayed, and maybe that's the reason for the future CDC guidance, that the messaging around safe gatherings with vaccination hasn't really been said publicly. And that's leading to people, so some people saying, well, what's the point of getting the vaccine anyway? But, you know, again, more and more of this messaging, I think, is really important.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center, infectious disease specialist, professor of medicine at UCSF. You can tweet at AirTalk. You can post on the AirTalk Facebook page and post on the AirTalk page with your questions, 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Thomas in Los Feliz says, I recently received my first dose of Pfizer. During the process, I had to answer a long list of questions, one of which asked if I had previously had symptoms of COVID-19. Is this really helpful, Thomas wonders, considering so many people are asymptomatic?
Yes, it's just as probably not as helpful, again, just like the way people do temperature screenings, because now we know from the data that most people don't have fevers when they're most transmissible, which is asymptomatic. So it's just really, you know, I think trying to capture any of the low-hanging fruit, but again, not being a very sensitive measure at all. So I agree with Thomas completely.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. My wife is a speech pathologist with the Glendale Unified School District, and she is co-leader of a group. She had a meeting last night. She had to attend for that. And so she asked if I would attend the Zoom webinar for parents and staff and family members on health and safety for the Glendale District, which is looking to reopen in the coming weeks with a hybrid model for those families that choose to go that way. And it was a very strong presentation, I thought. County Office of Education was involved, LA County Department of Public Health, the kinds of in-classroom protocols that are going to be followed was laid out, the comparatively low risk of spread of COVID-19 in a school environment if the protocols are followed, all of this laid out to sort of set the table for the case that this would be a safe school reopening even prior to all teachers being vaccinated. Then later last night, I see on television a 30-second ad by the California Teachers Association essentially making the case why their members should not be compelled to return to the classroom before they're all vaccinated. It was like a tale of two different worlds. The meeting last night, Glendale Unified, full of science and all kinds of graphs and studies showing the spread of COVID-19, even in areas with high case rate, what the risk would be inside schools, and the teachers' union making the case that the risk is too high in communities where there's a high rate of COVID-19. And so I'm just wondering, Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, you know, seeing this sort of stark, different interpretation of risk, where you come down?
I come down in thinking that it's actually very safe to reopen schools, particularly for the kids who need it the most, which are elementary school kids. We have so much data now saying it's safe. And data comes from real life practice. It's not just data in a lab. this is data from real life scenarios. You know, one of the more compelling studies, for example, looked at 13 school districts in Wisconsin in the summer of 2020, when Wisconsin, if you recall, was having a terrible surge, and there were zero cases of confirmed school transmissions in those 13 school districts when masks were used and when social distance was practicing. Yesterday, the CDC released another report from Georgia. This is Marietta County in Georgia, where masking wasn't enforced and there wasn't good social distancing. And yet, even in that scenario, most of the transmissions came from teachers rather than from students. So if you do it badly and you don't do anything, the students are still not transmitting disease. If you do it well, you're not going to get any COVID in those scenarios. And multiple places across the country, even within our state, and private and parochial schools have been open all along. It's just setting up a bigger divide between the haves and the have-nots, and I'm just worried about that future consequence for these learners.
So one of the arguments that the teachers that are reluctant to go back into the classroom make is that they represent lower income students, multi-generation households, that you're going to have kids spreading it to each other and potentially sending it back into the households, and that there's a threat there. Do we have studies that give us the answer as to whether that's true?
Yes, we have national data showing that, and international data showing that below a certain age, the chances are very, very minuscule, regardless of what SES you come from, regardless of what ethnicity you come from. So national data in the U.S. shows that most of the transmissions occur between the ages of 20 and 50, more than 75%. And if you look at under 9 years old, only 2% of transmissions occurred in that group. And this is like as a country. And again, I mentioned sort of like the smaller studies that looked at school districts. We know from Korea early on in the pandemic, even from contact tracing, that when they looked at kids who were positive, which were a few kids, and they went to their households, if those kids were under 12, there was virtually very, very low percentage of people who got COVID from that index child case. So again, most of the transmissions occur in older individuals, adolescents, college-age kids, and up to the age of 50, and not the kids, no matter how much you splice and dice the pie.
The teachers resistant to going back into the classroom also make the argument that we have new strains of the virus, and as a result, that creates an increase in the chances of teachers and students contracting COVID-19. Your response to that?
The good news about the new strains of the virus is that there's no data showing that what we do to protect against them, masks, social distancing, washing hands, are any different. The way I think about new variants from a protection perspective is that, you know, we should be protected, exclamation point, meaning that we should use the protection. In fact, I think somebody yesterday told me a very wise comment, which is we have the right science now to know what to do to protect ourselves. The only variable is human behavior.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist, UC San Francisco Medical Center. He's professor of medicine, UCSF. We'll take your calls at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. We'll be back in just 90 seconds on Air Talk. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, Dr. Peter Chin Hong with us. Also want to remind you we have a very special program coming up Thursday evening. You're probably familiar with the Film Week series that I've done at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, that beautiful historic, what was the United Artists flagship theater on Broadway in downtown L.A., and all of the great films and wonderful post-screening conversations that we had there. Of course, with the pandemic, we're not doing that, but I'm launching a new series, Film Week and Chill, where I'm picking films that I particularly love. They're just sort of relaxing, kind of antidotes, if you will, to the very difficult past 12 months that we've all endured. And I'm beginning the series Thursday at 6:30 p.m. with The Incredibles, the wonderful Pixar animated film, which I thought should have been the best film chosen by the Academy in 2004. It did win the best animated feature category. We'll have the director of The Incredibles, Brad Bird, with us, the composer of its terrific score, Michael Giacchino, will be with us, Claudia Puig, our Film Week critic, Charles Solomon, Film Week critic and animation authority, author of numerous books on animation. The four of them will be joining me, and we invite you to join us Thursday night, 6:30. It's a virtual event. All you need to do is go to kpecc.org/in-person. Just register for the event. It's completely free. You'll get the link to join us live Thursday at 6:30 for our conversation. And if you've not seen The Incredibles, or it's been many years since you have, you can stream it on Disney Plus if you subscribe to that streaming service. It's also available for a few dollars for rent on Amazon Prime Video. So you got a couple places. You may even have a friend who's got the DVD or Blu-ray disc of it if you got your player to watch that as well. So you see the film on your own, then join us for the conversation Thursday evening at 6:30, kpecc.org/in-person. Dr. Peter Chin Hong with us. JSK asks on the page, what do you think about Dr. Michael Osterholm's concerns about the UK variant here in the U.S.? He says, he suggests we examine the data, consider giving single doses for everyone 65 plus to avoid what he believes could be an explosion of infections that could overwhelm hospitals.
So, you know, in terms of giving everyone a single dose, you mean giving more people a single dose versus giving...
Yes, I think that's... Yeah. So the idea is we're having a tough time getting everyone 65 plus vaccinated with a single dose.
Yes. I mean, I would, again, in a environment of limited supplies, as, you know, from a population-based level, it's not unreasonable to think about that scenario. When you look at the Pfizer-Moderna data, actually, with one dose, you can actually get 90% protection. So when you compare it to other vaccines like, you know, AstraZeneca, J&J at the 70% mark, it's not bad, actually. The question, I think, really is not about the absolute protection immediately, but what's the durable protection? And with these mRNA vaccines, from the way that they've conceptualized it, we don't know how long it will last with the one dose. But again, with a strategy of just immunizing as many people as possible to prevent the bad stuff from COVID in the face of variants, again, it's not an unreasonable strategy. It's not also an unreasonable strategy to mix and match, because at the end of the day, you're developing neutralizing antibodies against the spike proteins, no matter how you deliver the message. So some thinking, again, with logistical, hurdles is that, you know, if you can immunize as many people as possible, and then you give people a second doses when you can, with whatever you have, it may be okay. But again, people may not go there based on the science.
All right. We have Linda in Glendale, who said, I've heard there are cases where people have had swollen lymph nodes after they've received the vaccine or received odd readings on mammograms. Is that true?
I haven't seen any systematic sort of summary of it being more common in people who've received the vaccine. But specifically around lymph nodes, for example, it would not be an unexpected finding, because, again, what the vaccine is doing is waking up your immune system, those neutralizing antibodies. And as the immune system gets activated, the way it can manifest, just like fevers or, you know, soreness or fatigue, is swollen lymph nodes. After all, that's kind of the clearinghouse of the immune system in some regards. So they get swollen whenever they get active. And so it's not necessarily an infection or something bad. It's just that, again, part of the spectrum of your immune system being woken up.
We have Judy, who writes on our Facebook page, how long after having a case of COVID-19 should one wait before being vaccinated?
That's a great question from Judy. So the guidance right now is you can wait 3 months safely and potentially longer. But again, 3 months is kind of gives you a good cushion window for the range of responses. We know that people who get natural infection will probably have detectable antibodies 7 to 9 months after the infection. But there's a range as much as 1,000-fold between some people and others. That's why even people who had COVID should get the vaccine, but they can wait 3 months. And there is also some data showing that maybe they don't need 2 shots of Pfizer, Moderna, or the 2-shot vaccines. They can just get away with 1 shot. Given that background.
Max in the Miracle Mile District says every year we have a different formulation of flu vaccine. And if not enough people get vaccinated for COVID-19, is there a chance that there will be a new vaccine that will need to be developed in the future, similarly to how the flu vaccine evolves?
That's a great question from Max. So flu is much more challenging, believe it or not, than COVID in terms of the vaccine. That's why the vaccine efficacy for flu is only from 40 to 60%. It just depends on what the flu season looks like every year. And the reason why the flu season looks different every year is that the flu virus has all these different kinds of, almost like different cassettes on the surface. So it's like mix and match. So there's H's and N's, and you can like mix and match them, and you can recombine animal strains into human strains into pigs, et cetera. So every year it's different, and multiple, what they do is they look to see what happens in the other hemisphere for their winter, and they guess what's going to happen in our hemisphere for our winter. But sometimes the guess isn't right. COVID is COVID. It's just like one virus that's changing only from these variant mutations that we all know about, but it's not mixing and matching these cassettes on the surface. So it's just going to be variations of the COVID rather than completely different strains, which is what we do in flu. We do 4 strains, we like guess them, and sometimes, but they're like a whole repertoire of multiple strains of flu.
Roy asks on our AirTalk page, would you recommend sending a 4-year-old to school if they live with a 64-year-old who's not yet been vaccinated?
I think if the school has the right strategies in place for school opening, I would be okay with it. But it all depends on what the school district is doing. But yes, I mean, a 4-year-old will be less likely to both acquire and transmit COVID from the data that we know of. And if you add protections on top of it, I think you would potentially lower that risk. But again, you know, these are tough situations, and it all depends on people's comfort and whether or not that older person in the household maybe has immunocompromising conditions, you know, may moderate how you think about it. But again, I worry about kids who haven't been in school, at least in the Bay Area and San Francisco, for more than a year now. And, you know, people are scrambling to find alternatives to public schools right now amongst people I know.
Well, and it just seems to me, Doctor, that, you know, a lot of this is personal decision. You factor in what are underlying risk factors for the 64-year-old? How much of a burden has it been for the 4-year-old to stay at home and do, you know, kindergarten or pre-K, you know, from a distance? That, you know, there's a lot of this is gray area.
Yes, and also, can you be a good companion for homeschooling for your kid, or to supervise the 4-year-old on Zoom? You know, all of those need. And does the school provide any other resources? And community of color, the school provides more resources, like, you know, food and other programs that beyond the sort of didactic education. So all of these need to be considered. You're right, Larry.
We'll continue with Dr. Peter Chin-Ong, UC San Francisco School of Medicine, infectious disease specialist. We're at 866-893-KPCC. We have so many questions. I'm really trying to pick and choose the ones that I think would have the greatest application to the most number of people, also ones that have not been asked before or at least haven't been asked in several days. So please bear with me. I'm sorry that I can't get to every single question. We're doing our best. We'll come back in just 1 minute. Caroline in Costa Mesa wanted to clarify, Dr. Chin-Ong. She heard you say that vaccinated adults have a higher likelihood of transmitting COVID-19 than children. I didn't hear that, so I just wanted to clarify. Had you said that?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Vaccinated adults probably have a very low transmission potential as we know it, but we just don't have the data. There's data in AstraZeneca and others showing that when you check the nasal swabs of those who've been vaccinated, there is at least a 70% chance, lower likelihood of detection of virus. So we make the leap that it probably means that there is less transmission to other humans, but we just don't have that data yet.
Okay, very good. And what is the theory for why kids do not transmit the virus as readily as adults?
So there are two possible theories that have been used to explain it. One is sort of anatomical. So when kids speak and they talk, if you look at many kids, sure, some of them raise their heads, but you know, it kind of just goes to the ground. So if you're tall and you're looming above them as an adult, they're not pushing, you know, the gravity will just bring down the droplets, even if it's aerosolized. Secondly, they've actually done studies of kids who are hospitalized for other reasons and looked in their noses for biopsies, and they found much fewer receptors, those ACE2 receptors, which can, you know, it's kind of the five-star hotel for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, much fewer in those kids. And the idea is that they develop in more numbers and frequency as we get older. So for both anatomical and biological reasons, kids are sort of like the protected ones for COVID-19.
Barbara in Hollywood recently bought an N95 mask, but now she's wondering whether it's an authentic one that's been tested. Also wondering about how to make sure that it's properly fitted to her, because that is a requirement of the N95 having its effectiveness. How can she check to make sure that it's not a counterfeit? And secondly, how do you test for fit? Are there YouTube videos or things like that?
Yeah, so the fit test is something we do in the hospital for healthcare workers, mainly for the real card-carrying aerosolized airborne spread viruses, tuberculosis, and measles. So it's done in a very systematic way with a dye of some sort, or a dye equivalent. So it's not something that we can do at home. I think from COVID perspective, the main thing that this virus is in terms of a card-carrying virus, is a droplet virus. The aerosolizing is only kind of when it gets superposed, which is not its main character. So CDC and other bodies do not recommend doing fit testing for most people when they use the N95 masks for that reason. So to summarize, I don't recommend doing that. Certainly, personally speaking, I don't use an N95 mask out of the hospital. But if you have to use it, I would be happy, as long as, just like with other masks, and we hear about that recently, we've heard about that recently, making sure it just fits snugly against your face is the main attribute I'd worry about. And then in terms of counterfeiting, yeah, there have been lots of reports of counterfeiting with KN95 masks, N95 masks, and KF94 masks. So once the KN95s from China, KF94s from Korea, the N95s from like a lot, you know, a large number of them come from the US from 3M, but it's hard to really detect counterfeits because most of them, the counterfeits use the 3M packaging, and it's really, really difficult. But if you're not sure where your mask comes from, look to make sure that it at least has EUA approval from the FDA if it is what it is written on the package is the real thing.
Also wanted to ask you about a study that's been conducted by Oxford researchers looking at a rheumatoid arthritis drug. It's sold under the brand name Actemra by Genentech. It's apparently used to try and deal with the cytokine storm that can result in the immune system. Have you had a chance to look at the findings for treatment of COVID-19?
Yeah, so these Oxford scientists who have a great reputation now because they were the ones who showed that using a very cheap steroid, dexamethasone, can actually prevent deaths. It's actually the only study until this one to show a mortality benefit from a therapeutic in severe COVID-19. What they did is they divided the group into those who just got steroids and other routine supportive care versus this new agent, rheumatoid arthritis drug called tocilizumab, or we call it TOCI for short in the hospital, plus steroids. And they showed that there was a decrease of death of 20%, which was statistically significant. But the caveats are that, when you look at the absolute percentage of the people in both arms who died, it's 33%. In the steroid-only arm versus 27% in the double arm. So when you think about the cost of it, which is $2,300 a dose,
ooh,
right now we're not using it as routine care yet. I think the way it will probably pan out is if somebody's really, really serious, you give them the antiviral, remdesivir, you give them the steroids, and they're still not doing well and they're in the ICU, we can add tocilizumab as an extra agent, but probably not up front is probably the way it will pan out.
Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, it's always a pleasure. Enjoy the nice weather up in San Francisco as we are here in Southern California, and we're enjoying even more the drop in COVID-19 cases. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thanks so much, Larry.
I'm sure looking forward to the time when I get to meet him face to face. We've never had that opportunity with a year of talking about COVID-19, and that's true for the rest of the cast of our outstanding medical experts who join us daily to talk COVID-19 on Air Talk.